When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 449th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of the most consequential investigative journalists of our time. He's only 34, but he already has on his shelf a Pulitzer Prize for Public Service, awarded in 2018, the same year Time listed him as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. In the wake of his October 10th, 2017 reporting for The New Yorker, about sexual misconduct by Harvey Weinstein, which, on the heels of the New York Times reporting from 5 days earlier, helped to bring down that movie mogul and ignite the Me Too movement. As the Financial Times described him, he is, quote, one of America's most dogged reporters, relentless in the pursuit of powerful men alleged to have abused their positions, close quote, including not just Weinstein, but also CBS chief Les Moonves and New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, whose downfalls he helped to bring about. He wrote about his Weinstein reporting in the New York Times bestselling book Catch and Kill, Lies, Spies, and a Conspiracy to Protect Predators, which was published in October of 2019. He began rolling out a podcast of the same name, featuring audio of interviews related to his work, in November of 2019. And in July of 2021, HBO, with whom he has a multi-year deal to produce documentaries, debuted Catch and Kill, the podcast Tapes, a film documentary series version of that podcast, directed by Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato, and on which he served as an executive producer. The Grim Reaper of Bad Men, Ronan Farrow. Over the course of our conversation, Farrow reflected on his childhood as an academic prodigy, and also how he may have been shaped by the widely reported turbulence within his own family, including when his mother, Mia Farrow, became aware of a relationship between his father, Woody Allen, and his adopted sister, Sunyi Previn, in January of 1992, and when his sister, Dylan Farrow, in August of 1992, accused Allen of having molested her. What led him to journalism, initially on TV, before frustrations with NBC's unwillingness to air his findings about Weinstein led him to The New Yorker? How he approaches his interviews, as seen on Catch and Kill, the podcast Tapes, and how his past reporting successes have both helped and hindered him in later investigations, plus much more. And so without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Ronan, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Great to have you. And we always begin on this podcast with just a couple of basics. I think people are probably more familiar with your answer than most, but we ask where folks were born and raised and what their parents did for a living.
I was born in New York and raised in New York and Connecticut. I think I identify more than anything else as a New England boy. And I grew up in an entertainment industry family. I guess, as you point out, most people know that about me.
Well, I think that just one kind of side fun fact that I wonder if we can address before we get to more serious things. You were not born with the name Ronan. I think you were actually, I know, named after the great pitcher, Satchel Paige. How did it come to Ronan?
Well, I have a hilariously convoluted name. There's a lot of names that have moved in and out of different legal documents as I've renewed them. I'm trying, just for TSA pre-check purposes, to really consolidate to either just Ronan Farrow or Ronan O'Sullivan Farrow, which the O'Sullivan has always been in there. They've all always been in there, as I understand it, that it's that I had too many middle names. This is the peril of, like, the Hollywood phenomenon of throwing a million names at a kid. So, you know, some documents, I think my Irish passport is, like, Ronan Seamus Farrow. I think the satchel is still in some documents. I think the, you know, the Ronan has always been kind of the lead thing since, like, pretty early in my childhood. But yes, they've moved around. I haven't really used the satchel in recent years, but you know, maybe it's time. Maybe, you know, when I write that great American novel, I keep, meaning to get around to, I'll be Satchel O'Sullivan or something.
Well, the O'Sullivan, if people don't know, I mean, they know, I think most people know that Farrow is, comes from your mother, who's a great actress. But O'Sullivan is also, there's a great acting history there as well, right?
Yes, given that we're on the Awards Chatter podcast, there's Hollywood connections on several of my convoluted names. There's a Villiers in there, and John Villiers Farrow was a director. He won an Oscar for writing Around the World in 80 Days. He was a screenwriter too, and directed, you know, a lot of like great old noir pictures. And the O'Sullivan was from my grandmother, Maureen O'Sullivan, who was Jane in the Tarzan movies.
Yes.
And
yes.
Like, you know, if you turn on Turner Classic Movies, she's on there all the time. It was the contract player era. So they really worked them to the bone. The IMDb credits for actors from that era and directors, too, are so much crazier because they, you know, they just didn't have any say in the matter and they'd crank out six or seven movies a year or something.
Now, when you were a kid, is it within your memory that, you know, being on set, seeing your mom working, or was that sort of not something you were as exposed to?
Yes and no. I mean, I have a lot of vivid memories of being on movie sets, and that was a formative part of my childhood. And, you know, my mom was a great example of a working single mom who, like, made it work. You know, she figured out childcare on sets, and she always had us close. It wasn't like I dealt with absent parenting because of the movie set piece of my childhood. So that's a cool and difficult thing. But I also then had a pretty significant tract of my upbringing that was just in rural Connecticut. And probably to the extent that I'm not insufferable, it's like a little bit a result of not being an LA kid, an industry kid.
And you would have been in Connecticut because that's where your unbelievable academic career was beginning to unfold. I mean, can I just note for our listeners, I know you're probably sick of hearing these stats, but everybody else is going to be blown away.
Oh, yeah, it's so terrible to hear about being a child prodigy, Scott. It's really insulting. I hate it.
Well, here we go. Started university at 11. At 15, the youngest person ever to graduate from Bard College, then accepted to Yale Law School right after that, but deferred to go work for Richard Holbrook and UNICEF. 21, graduated from Yale Law School, and then we're back in State Department stuff, and 23, a Rhodes Scholar. But I guess it was starting where it became clear that you were maybe more academically gifted than others. That was in Connecticut?
You missed my PhD, Scott. How could you?
Excuse me.
That's not a joke. I spent 7 years on it.
I know. At Oxford.
You're kind to say, like, to frame it in terms of, you know, when my intellectual prowess became apparent. I think what became apparent in retrospect was the yawning chasm of gay insecurity that drove me to get a degree hunt. There was also genuine intellectual curiosity, and I did always have fun in school, and, you know, I don't think they knew quite what to do with me, so they kept skipping me grades. And therefore I'm, you know, as socially dysfunctional as you see on display here, Scott. It was a fun experience for me, and I was lucky. You know, Yale Law is a small place, and the scholarship program was a small one. I kind of, like, managed to maintain a Montessori school vibe all the way through my graduate degrees, and was in, like, small, relatively nurturing groups of people. So, you know, the accumulated trauma of my life doesn't come from the school experience. It's mostly a happy part of my life, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would do it for like my kids. I was very much in the driver's seat, though. I was impossible to control. You know, I had like the opposite of helicopter parenting. I was like forcing everyone along for the ride as I did all this. And, well, now I'm 11 and I got to get to college every day. So, you know, credit to my mom for like going along with that. I think I would, you know, really sit down and talk to any child of mine about whether they really, really wanted to give up that particular thing people get of being in a shared social group with people their age through all those years. Like, I have great friendships going back to grade school, but it is different because I skipped around. Sure.
Yeah. Well, given what you have come to do a lot of your journalism work about, I just am curious, do you feel that some of the awareness of things that were going on around your parents' relation and the stuff with your sister, Dylan, that's obviously you've been written about and documented. Were you aware of all this stuff growing up? Do you think it shaped your interests in what you ended up, you know, shaped what you ended up pursuing? Or was that almost just a coincidence?
Oh, sure. I was aware. It's funny. I was recently like at CVS buying ice cream novelties in the middle of the night or something. I really like one of those moments where you're not necessarily ready to talk about your life, and someone came up and said, like, you know, you look a lot like Ronan Farrow. You must get that all the time. And then I kind of said, yeah, sure, I get it all the time. Then he came back and he was like, I just wanted to let you know that that wasn't supposed to be an insult. And he said some nice things about me. And then he said, I think maybe because we were masked, like genuinely not knowing that it was me. Like, and also I'm sure you had a better childhood than he did.
Oh, no.
And I was God. Wow, I really, am I known for having like, you know, an incredibly shitty childhood? I see a lot of privilege in my background, you know, and I try to own that. But I also think as the years have passed, I've become less afraid of acknowledging that, you know, it was all pretty, pretty messed up too. And I do think to your question, I draw considerable strength from that. And, I also think it, you know, did give me some backdrop of awareness of some of the issues that ultimately entered into my reporting. And, you know, like the reporting on sexual violence is a pretty small sliver of what I've done over the years, but I'm proud to have been a part of exposing some of the things that I exposed. And I do think, you know, my own experiences empowered me to get through conversations, many of which I've written about whether those were issues worth reporting on, worth the risks associated with reporting on them.
And just to speak to the fact that you do have a sense of humor about some of the weirder sides of things that you've experienced, I think one of your probably most favorited tweets of many creative ones that you've put out there, this was in 2012, if I may quote, "Happy Father's Day," or as they call it in my family, "Happy Brother-in-Law's Day." So, I mean, you acknowledge it, but I guess it's, what can you do? You can laugh or cry probably about some of this stuff, right?
Or a lot of both. Also, yeah. The halcyon days of Twitter. I mean, remember when one could just be jokey on Twitter before it was like a place where you go to look for you know, people telling you to die in a fire and get cancer all day.
Oh, God.
it's interesting. I don't know how much of it is just the discourse becoming intrinsically broken on Twitter and how much of it is like, you know, I had 20,000 followers then and now I have a million followers or whatever. Maybe it's that you just can't be at a certain level of prominence on there. But it did become an unusable platform, whether it's that the platform changed or my profile on the platform changed. You know, it used to be a thing where I'd go on late night comedy shows and they'd like read my funniest tweets. And it was a way of communicating with other reporters. And, you know, it was kind of fun. You could banter. And it became too toxic and destructive. Mm-hmm. So obviously Elon's going to clean all of that up.
Well, so here's something I've always wondered about you, because, and you were nice enough you were nice enough to come speak to a group of journalism students who I teach on the weekends. And one of the things, though, that I didn't get to ask you,
by the way, it's great that you do that. Anytime I get to give probably dubious advice to youths, I will grab that chance.
No, well, I hope you realize what a hero you are to this next generation of journalists. But I guess part of what I should have asked you there is how you even wound up moving towards journalism yourself, because again, when we look back at all of these different varied academic pursuits of yours and then even real world things that you were doing with State Department and traveling the world and all kinds of things up to and including, I believe, something with, was it the Centers for Disease Control or something in like before the pandemic, you were getting into science.
Wow, that's going deep. Yeah. way back during law school, I did, but one of my summers I did the sellout big law thing, but I also did do a summer where I went and worked in the slums of Kibera for the CDC, which was like super interesting. I just felt like I got to be around good people doing good stuff. It's good for the soul. Sometimes you need that when you're in law school. But yeah, if the question is how I got
starting probably with MSNBC, right? Was that where you were initially just appearing on other programs right before you ended up with your own?
Well, it started in print. I was in some of these places. It was the kind of UNICEF phase that you mentioned and working in places where I felt like I was seeing things where there were stories to tell. So I was doing increasingly reported but small op-ed pieces and cold submitting them to all the newspapers and, struck up relationships with the op-ed pages. I don't know how that landscape has changed. Like I have in my muscle memory, some investment in the world of op-ed pages, but it does feel like talking to young people, that platform maybe, has waned in cultural significance. But at the time, I think it was still significant enough that it really helped me to get my voice out there on things I thought were important. And, it's the op-ed format, so it's a little prescriptive. But I kind of increasingly just naturally found myself pushing it in more of almost a Nick Kristof direction where, yes, it's prescriptive a little bit, but mainly it's, it's reported. And I was interviewing people in Darfur, and I was, trying to carry the stories of others. And then in the same phase, as you point out, I was I started doing, CNN hits and stuff, and talking about some of those same issues, mainly human rights issues, mainly international stuff. And then that kind of just evolved from there. I think Phil Griffin, who was running MSNBC at the time, saw a speech I had given, saw some of my hits. I don't know, you'd have to ask him what the inspo was exactly, but he wanted to bring me in. I think simultaneously there were network people at NBC. I think it was, who was running the Today Show at the time? Don Nash, maybe, wanted to bring me in on the network side. And I think as Phil described it, he was like, nope, I want to talk to him about doing a show. So then I did a year of an MSNBC show, which is super interesting in terms of how it's informed my thoughts on the rapidly shifting cable landscape.
Yeah.
But I was using that platform by the end of it for also more heavily reported long tape pieces. We talked about this a little with your students, that I was doing this incongruous thing by the end that I was really proud of and we were getting awards for and we were getting positive notice for by the end of that year. Where there'd be 20-minute investigative pieces I'd go out and do on the weekends and then just put on this show in the middle of the day, which is not at all. I mean, nobody, there's no ratings bonanzas in the middle of the day. That was a really, really ratings depressed period. It was, Obama time, and there was nothing for Dems to push against, and there was like this ideological hangover where there was a little pressure to be more partisan. And I was like, I kind of want to be more repertorial. The irony is, I think right after that, they got into more of a like, oh, now there's opposition and things are a little more exciting for our base. And also a, well, we want to be more straight news kind of mindset. But the moment I was in, it was like, everyone's got to be as partisan as possible, and maybe we can recapture that sizzle. And I was doing something that cut against the grain of that. And so after my show ended, I was then like, I was a Today Show guy, and I did, you know, investigative stories for them in nightly news. And I think that naturally just flowed into getting more investigative.
Yeah.
The print stuff I ultimately wound up doing, the HBO series that I'm, you know, working on now, series plural, like we put one out a few months ago, and then I'm shooting a few now. Yeah, so it's I still love daily TV, and I put in my hours getting good at that arcane thing of being a broadcaster, and I have a lot of respect for people who do that. It's a, you know, it is like a learned discipline that you have to get polished at. But I also have felt like this lane of like deeper storytelling is meaningful. And I think I've been reticent when I've had conversations about going back to more regular shows, including in my current deal. It was like, you know, do you want to do a show? I think that I want to, the stuff that I'm doing now is like 1 foot in talk and 1 foot in doc. If you look at the podcast tapes, the last show that we did, exactly, it is like it's an interview talk format, but with documentary elements. So I think, you know, what I've taken away from all of this is the deeper storytelling is something that will survive the ravages of the business model changes. And there's interesting work to be done in playing with these more regular formats and incorporating some of those deeper elements. So that's where I'm now. I'm doing the journalism thing and experimenting on the TV side.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Not to bring everything back to The Hollywood Reporter, but I have to ask you, I think that we may have played a small role in setting you on the path to writing about sexual misconduct, right? Because there was a story, a cover that was done on May 4th, 2016 about Woody Allen that I don't think you were, and rightly, particularly happy with. And then I think, did you have a conversation with Janice about Janice Minn, our editor at the time, about like,
she reached out to me. Yeah, it was a piece that was getting a lot of blowback because it was kind of an older male profile writer and written through a pure entertainment lens. And it was like this kind of lionizing profile of here's this charming nebbish and isn't it a lovely thing that he's overcome all these slings and arrows. And let's just talk about the work. And look, I think I'm not a big fan of, you know, unnuanced shutting people out of the conversation. I would never propose that people should, you know, be hesitant to profile Woody Allen or talk about his work or whatever. I do think, like, you know, if you're a journalistic outlet, you have a responsibility to ask the tough questions about the tough things. So I was sympathetic to Janice's concerns when she called and said, like, we're getting all this blowback for this thing, you know, which was a sign of a changing cultural moment, right? Like, there was a moment where you can't do, I think, and I don't think this is true of every, you know, frivolous transgression. I don't think, like, everyone should be asked about every unflattering thing in every interview. But I think, like, if you've been through a legal process where a prosecutor has said, like, we have probable cause to pursue rape charges, but we're not because of the fragility of the victim. Like, you know, these are, and you've got, you know, a bunch of credible evidence around like serious violent crime. I think that is the level where the blowback was correct. Like you got to ask maybe a question, right?
And so was it was really not something you had publicly addressed very much prior to that point when you were
I think my desire was to, you know, get as far away from it as possible. And you're absolutely right that call from Janice saying, hey, would you write about this? Because you're at this interesting intersection of like, this is your family, but also you're a journalist. And, you know, there's this critique of our journalistic values. I mean, props to her. That's a cool move. And like, also sad. She's such a savvy businesswoman. Like, it's a savvy move. Like, let's turn this these lemons into lemonade. Because it did, like, it created a double moment for the Hollywood Reporter. Yeah. So you know, good for her. And I had to deal with the firestorm of it. But I felt like it was the right thing to do. So I did write that op-ed, articulating that theory of the case. And it you know, I think the kind of repetition of that argument in activist circles and the caricature of it by people pushing back against those activist circles is very different from the actual argument, which is quite small in scale, which was like, if there's serious allegations of violent crime, you know, you ask the question, not like you cancel the celebrities, not like you never work with them. That those are all separate areas of discourse that I'll leave to others. Just like you got to ask the questions. And, you know, that flowed from my journalistic values and also my, you know, personal investment in the issues. Because, of course, we're not talking about just any kind of crime. We're talking about an area of sex crimes that I think had been, profoundly marginalized in the conversation. And so this, at that level of seriousness, deserved to be unmarginalized.
Yeah, and just for timeline purposes, the cover story that you were reacting to was May 4th, 2016. Your column was May 11th, 2016. And then I believe, according to Catch and Kill, I think it's fall of 2016 that you, having now gone into the NBC News investigative unit side of things, there's basically a pitch meeting and you suggest a Hollywood angle of an investigation. What do you think even made you go down that route? It wasn't a specific thing about in any way connecting back to your own family's dealings with this kind of subject matter. Why were you even? What do you think made you even think in those terms?
Well, the Hollywood Reporter op-ed did inform that because it clearly touched a nerve. And it was, you know, I can't take credit for that conversation. There's incredible activists who have worked on trying to, you know, elevate survivors of this kind of crime for years. But for whatever reason, my articulation or a man articulating, you know, whatever went into it kind of striking a chord, people found it unusual, which is, you know, a little sad. But that's the reality of the cultural backdrop against which that happened. And it resonated with, you know, people working in that field, with survivors of sexual violence, with people in the industry who had, you know, terrible stories. And there was clearly more to delve into there. So aside from anything else, just as a reporter with a nose for a scoop, like I felt like there was interesting storytelling to be done, excavating that a little more. And I did pitch and get the green light on a series about sort of, you know, Hollywood injustices or the dark side of Hollywood. And, you know, the casting couch was part of that. And that's how I wound up stumbling into the Weinstein stuff.
Well, but at that time when you're pitching the idea, there was no specific tip or anything saying, you know, there's actually this is going to lead to a whole bunch of examples of this. It was just that this is there were rumors, or what made you even think that there might be something there?
Well, there's a whole book you can read on this.
Yes, and, yes,
and also
yes, yes.
An incredible series directed by Randy and Fenton, the World of Wonder team. And it's a long and winding story, but it became apparent very early in that reporting process that there was a profusion of clues around a very serious perpetrator of serial violent crime, and it in a sense this sex crimes backdrop of that was significant, and in a sense it was actually all about it being insignificant, right? Because you have to have sort of trauma informed conversations in the course of that reporting, but also part of the project was sort of taking it out of the shadows and destigmatizing it as something different that couldn't be talked about in newsrooms. So I did, I on one level pursued it as I would any other big lead.
Yeah. Just a question of personal curiosity. When you, I say like, I'm going to tell my grandkids that it was an honor to be interviewed by Ronan as part of, I guess it was for a Today Show segment about Oscar campaigning mm-hmm. by Harvey. It was an honor to be interviewed without having done anything wrong. But I wonder though, because reading Catch and Kill, you've said that weirdly it was on that day that you were in our office. I guess you spoke mm-hmm. to Matt Bellany and
yes.
kind of got on a track that led to you, I think, being able to overcome the thing that had really been the biggest obstacle for anyone who had caught wind of Harvey's misbehavior, misconduct, which was that, how do you make somebody feel comfortable enough to speak about it on the record? It seems like, and this obviously does come up in the reporting, in the book, in the podcast, but I guess if you can just explain for somebody who hasn't yet gone into all those projects of yours, that was, I guess, the biggest obstacle, right? Just helping somebody to feel comfortable enough to open up to you.
Well, in any investigative story that's confronting, right, it's confronting because there's something that someone has an interest in keeping in the shadows. And, I deal with government whistleblowers all the time who have, a similar terror of coming forward. I don't think it's unique to the stories about personal trauma, but certainly it's an area of reporting where you encounter a very intense and complex reticence to talk, and you have to take a lot of time to work with sources and make sure that they are going in eyes open and are aware of the decision they're making, and feel empowered to do what they need to do in that. And in these projects, including the show, the podcast tapes, you can see the sources working through that decision making. I mean, one of the first episodes of the series is about Ambra Gutierrez, this model who preserved evidence from a police sting in kind of a daring caper. And she was so young and she did such a kind of brave thing. And she's a really magnetic communicator. So it's a gift that she is willing in this series to kind of pull back the curtain and talk in a very emotionally honest way about the decision to break $1 million NDA and risk repeating a thing that had already happened to her, which was a terrible smearing of her reputation and decimation of her career, in order to help other people. So that's like, there's a way in which this work and the stuff that you see unfolding in the series is wearying for me over time, but it also is something that's very empowering and that I draw strength from, because you get to see heroism in motion, and therefore the tone of the series is not defeatist. It is inspiring to me personally, aside from anything else. And I also think one thing that Randy and Fenton did a great job of in the, I kind of put together, with a couple of colleagues, but was very in the trenches on the scripts for the podcast. But Randy and Fenton really took the lead On the scripts for the series, using the same material but excavating totally different things from it. And one of the things they've done a great job of is creating a through line of tracking how these sources made their decisions. And so, you know, the answer to your question is really in the DNA of the show. You get to see Umbra deciding to speak. You get to see Rowena Chu, another source, deciding not to speak at the time. And, you know, the emotional costs of each of those decisions. And it's kind of all laid out in a very naked way.
Yep. These are 6 episodes dropped in July. People can still, of course, access it on HBO. But just chronologically, the way this was built up towards that, your piece in The New Yorker that kind of started all this was October 10th, 2017. Catch and Kill is October 2019. A month later is the Catch and Kill podcast starts rolling out. And I guess at that point you were already kind of thinking that there could be or partnering with the World of Wonder guys on a visual component as well, because obviously the podcasts were being filmed, right? So what was the thought there?
Well, it's a really interesting origin story for, you know, listeners who are into kind of the craft side of this. I did not have an intention to do a separate show using that material. I said to HBO, because I was in this overall deal with them and developing other unrelated things, I said, hey, I'm doing this podcast with these sources, and we should stick a camera in the room, like just a lo-fi, you know, put a GoPro in there. I've seen how that can be effective in the podcast world. You cut together a video version as well, and you put it on YouTube. You know, like Whitney Cummings does it for her podcast. Mm-hmm. That was the reference. You know, just like a simple podcasty, you know, kind of unproduced, just a very simple straight cut of maybe there's 2 cameras, and there was a kind of a cultural disjunction where HBO was kind of like we don't do that. Like, what are you talking about? You know, like we do incredible, beautiful work.
Like,
Whitney Cummings podcast, like, you know, YouTube clips. Like, what are you talking about? And so we went round and round a little bit. And, you know, finally I realized that the pipeline that they have is too sophisticated for the thing that I was trying to do, which was just day and date. There's a video version if you want it. And thank goodness, and they were completely right to kind of stick to their commitment to quality, which is that, you know, I've worked with a lot of different platforms. It's pretty unusual across the entertainment industry. HBO is like one of the last holdouts where it is kind of a quality first brand. I don't mean to chill for them. I don't need to say that. It's just something I feel as a viewer, right? Even on the scripted side. You know, they'll like cancel a gazillion-dollar Game of Thrones prequel pilot because it's just not good enough. There's not a ton of places that do that. And it is a little bit of, like, corporate culture is real. That's a small documentary unit. It's these incredible executives, Nancy Abraham and Lisa Heller, who worked under Sheila Nevins for years. And so, like, they're steeped in that culture of quality, and they only do really good stuff. And so they said, no, let's like hire the types of crews we usually hire and do it beautifully. And so, yeah, we wound up with this footage, which we just weren't using. They said, like, let's just shoot it and see what we get, which was a lot better than having a GoPro in the room. I don't mean just aesthetically, but in that you got up close and personal with these sources.
Can I just interject? Yeah. I just want to ask you, though, Rowan, because I was surprised that you were even entertaining the idea of having cameras in the room, only because in my experience, and I know you have a lot more of it with cameras being part of an interview, I feel that it changes some people get they can't fully let their guard down when there's a camera there. Like people have suggested we do it with this podcast because we're lucky to have a number of good, you know, really great guests. I think it changes the dynamic sometimes of the conversation. Was that a concern for you, especially given how sensitive, you know, that what you're talking about was going to be?
this is where the format and craft side of the conversation and the substantive journalistic side intersect, right? Because this, what came about kind of through happenstance, right? I'm doing a podcast, I'm booking people for a podcast interview, then I'm kind of saying, are you cool with there being a camera in the room? And by the way, there were a couple of interviews where, like, David Remnick didn't want a camera for his interview, you know? So that's, and that, and we still use that audio in the series, and they find these incredible ways to visualize around the kind of gaps in the footage. But mostly people said yes. And it is two things. I think that part of the challenge of my work as a journalist who also works in TV has always been to get across that divide you're talking about. And I firmly believe it can be done. It requires a sensitive touch, but you can get people to open up in that same way on camera. And, like, that's part of the discipline that you study as a TV interviewer. You know, you want people to not be on guard, and you want to create a space where it's not different because of the cameras. And that's, I think, that's part of how you go truly deep and get real insight. And the format of it's a podcast, but also there's a camera in the room. And the fact that the way that this just came together through happenstance meant that we had, like, really well-produced footage that could get up close and intimate, and wasn't just, like, a standard talk show-looking thing, but was kind of a talk format. I don't know. It all conspired to create a situation where people really opened up and were raw and vulnerable, and kind of you didn't feel the presence of the camera in terms of the emotional tenor of the conversation. And then the way that Randy and Fenton, World of Wonder, kind of took that material and excavated the most kind of raw emotional core of it, and then also found this brilliant balance of, like, yes, you're in the room with me, and it's this intimate conversation between two people in each episode, but also you're journeying out into the B-roll that they've found, and the clips from my reporting and the audio from my reporting, they're covering it in a way that gives it a fuller body and makes it this kind of hybrid format that I honestly hadn't seen before. And when HBO came to me, I don't know, a year after the fact or something, and said, you know, the podcast was a hit and found an audience, and they said, we want to do something with the footage now, I really dragged my feet. I really said, like, I don't see a precedent for a remix of podcast material that 10 million people have already downloaded a year after the fact. Like, what is that?
Right.
And it's completely no credit to me, and all credit to them and to the World of Wonder team, that they did something that I think is a little innovative. I think it's, like, it is a different format than anything I've seen because of this weird origin story of how it came together. It's like, I'm with the mics. It's a podcast. You're breaking the fourth wall. It's casual. It's intimate. It gets around that problem you're talking about of people shutting down when cameras are there. And it's, like, beautifully covered in this way that also makes it work as a TV series. You don't feel like you're just locked in a room. So that's a lot of my work that I'm doing now with HBO for these other series is like expanding on and iterating on that format, because totally by accident, when I said, okay, like, let's see what they come up with, not really being optimistic and thinking that it was going to be this kind of double-edged sword, like, oh, is it too much? Is it going to feel like a retread? Instead, when I started to see what they envisioned for it, I got really excited creatively as someone who struggled with the challenge of how do you kind of shake up talk formats. And then it, you know, it did well for them. It really found an audience, which I never would have expected, because, like, you know, how many bites at that apple do people want? But they found something different in it. They really did. And it is a different experience. And so many people come up to me and say, you know, I read the book, I listened to the podcast, I watched the show. So I, you know, they're like miracle workers.
Well, I'm one of those people, and I've found that one of the most interesting things about the watching the show is that, again, maybe it's partly because I'm in journalism as well, but I'm very curious to see you doing an interview in a way, you know, we can hear you doing it on the podcast, but to just see and try to kind of figure out the secret sauce in a way of what you do to make people as comfortable as they are with you and to open up to you. And I guess I'm curious, do you yourself, is it about the setting of where you have these conversations? Is it something that you inherently bring to the table as somebody who they know has been very close to people in similar situations? Is it something, I mean, I've read something where you were saying, and you know, I wouldn't have even occurred to me, but that you are openly gay. You say maybe the fact that maybe some women who have been through terrible things feel somewhat less leered at or whatever when they're talking about sexual things in that setting. I guess I just wonder, anything you can diagnose about why people love talking to you?
Well, it's kind of you to put it that way. I mean, I think it's more generalized than that, right? Because I have to pull off the same hat trick whether I'm talking to, you know, a government whistleblower or like a dissident somewhere around the world or a survivor of a terrible crime. And I think the answer is all of the above. There is an element of bringing yourself to the table when you do an interview. And you're right that you can see that in the show in a way that is more evident than in any of the other projects surrounding this. I think that Randy and Fenton really liked the idea of this, the stuff that I kind of had been careful of about emphasizing too much because I don't want it to be about me. They brought to light more because they had more distance from it and they didn't have that reticence. So you get to see the process. And I think as best as I can tell, it is a combination of things. It's patience, it's empathy, it's trying to really listen to someone and their concerns, both in an interview and also in conversations about whether they're going to give an interview. And it's also, it is bringing yourself. It's I have a double-edged sword. It's a painful thing that people know a lot more about me than I know about them generally, you know, in any interaction. And it's not all great stuff, but I can't change that. All I can do is kind of be open and vulnerable about that. And if you're asking others to be open and vulnerable, I think it helps to kind of be in that space yourself, which doesn't mean I'm talking about myself a lot, but I think there is a tacit acknowledgement that a lot of the people that I'm approaching in whatever area of journalism kind of know me a little bit. And yeah. I do think that to the extent that what you say is true, that people love to talk to me, I think that is probably part of it. And, you know, they did a great job with this show of striking a balance where it isn't about me, but you do see that process in a way that I think brings to light more in the sources. And there you can see the wheels turning and how they make those decisions. And the editing, the score, all of it is so kind of sensitively calibrated around telling those stories. I was so kind of bowled over by what they did with it.
Well, you've mentioned there are other upcoming projects that you're doing with HBO, and I wonder, are they, just before I even ask part B of this question, are they related to similar, you know, types of misconduct, or is it completely unrelated subject matter?
Well, you can see in my print reporting, up to and including the piece in the last New Yorker yep. about surveillance. And espionage culture, some of the themes that I've been looking at, and the types of stories over the last few years, you can track that. And beyond that, I can't talk about investigations that are ongoing.
Totally. No, the only reason I ask is because I'm curious if you have found that establishing yourself as somebody very well known for on this particular kind of subject matter, has that made your job in reporting on other subject matter easier or harder? I will just note, I don't know if you were laughing at this when it was said, but this was on the less than a year after your New Yorker piece was published, Colin Jost hosting the Emmys, and he says, quote, "Netflix, of course, has the most nominations tonight. That's right. And if you're a network executive, that's the scariest thing you can possibly hear, except maybe Sir Ronan Farrow is on line one," close quote. And it was, it got a laugh in the room, and it's kind of the kind of, you know, the idea is
everybody's done that joke. Trevor Noah did that joke this year at the correspondents' dinner.
Well, so, but I guess the
everyone is afraid that Ronan Farrow is going to come. Right. This is why I don't get invited to things, Scott.
Well, no. Well, I guess, though, is there an element of truth to that? That does it make it harder to do reporting now in some respects? Obviously, on terms of sexual misconduct, everybody probably knows that you are the most trustworthy, credible person on that subject matter. But when it comes to other stuff, has it made it more difficult?
I hope it's not. That's not the narrow tenor of the reputation that I've built. I mean, most of my work prior to that few stories, you know, I'm proud of that handful of stories, but most of the work that I've done, you know, my first book was about the kind of decimation of the State Department under several administrations. All of that early writing that we talked about was on kind of international human rights stuff. The majority of the New Yorker material that I've put out is, you know, about other forms of crime and corruption. So I haven't thought of it in terms of it being like a single beat occupation in the way that you're describing. And like, maybe, you know, that was a seismic moment culturally. So maybe there are people who associate me closely with that. And that's something that I'm only proud of. But you know, I think it's telling that those jokes at all those award shows up to and including this year's award shows are, you know, they're about people being scared of a tough investigative reporter calling. They're sometimes in rooms that where the joke isn't just about are people lechy.
Right.
I think it's like, sadly for me, it's a double-edged sword, right? Like, the people are scared to get my call because they know perhaps there will be tough questions in any genre, on any topic. I also think, though, that, yeah, those are jokes or caricatures about my toughness or whatever as a reporter, but I'm prominent in a way that gets people to talk to. It's not all downside. And for every politician I call where it like gets punted to their legal team very, very quickly and they're just freaked out to talk to me, there's several more in my experience who, you know, will pick up the phone and hear me out. And the reality is too, most of the calls I'm making, Scott, are not like, may I ask you about this terrible crime? Most of them are, I'm working on issue X and, you know, you right. could be a supportive source who could inform my knowledge of whatever arcane point.
Right.
So that's my, you know, that's my final thought. Yeah. People should pick up the phone when I call.
Right. and as they can hear, you're a very nice guy. It's not nothing to be scared of. Like, well, maybe, but depending on what they've done. But I guess one of the things that we talked about when you spoke to the students in my class, which I want to come back to if it's all right, is, you know, there are some people who have covered very heavy, dark stuff like you have, not just the sexual misconduct, but other stuff where there's been a suggestion that you can actually get secondhand PTSD, in a sense, that you're around people who have been terribly traumatized. You obviously, as we see on this special or on the documentary series, have such empathy, which is a wonderful thing. But I wonder if it also makes you vulnerable to hurting yourself. Like, is there a way to guard against that? Do you do anything to guard against that?
Well, it's I was talking with someone who's working on a project where she has to be writing about me, and this came up. I think that there was a period of time where I was so committed to not being the story, and particularly as someone who has an intrusive, very public background, that for a long time I tried to outrun and kind of had a chip on my shoulder about wanting to avoid, you know, wanting desperately to be known for my own work. So then, especially when working on things that are urgent and important and about the journeys of others, the often very difficult journeys of others, I was so committed to deflecting every question about me. You know, if you look back at whenever the first year or two of interviews around some of those investigative stories about sex crimes, I was constantly having to say, you know, this is about the sources, and let's pivot. And I stand by that. You know, I think that that is correct and was the right thing for me to do as a reporter. But I think it's therefore made it a longer process to confront what some of these experiences did to me. And, you know, it's something I write about in even this latest New Yorker piece about spyware technology. Being surveilled is not just information gathering. It's a form of intimidation. And I'm very conscious of the fact that there are reporters in a lot of places in the world who have it a lot worse and might wind up dead any day for speaking truth to power. But yeah, I did do work that got me followed around a bunch and got, like, you know, entrapment operations by, you know, tabloids sent after me, all stuff that I wrote about in Catch and Kill. Yeah. And, like, people with fake identities trying to insinuate themselves into my life and, you know, terrible opposition, sort of smear efforts, you know, dossiers about me being trafficked, and, you know, there's always someone unscrupulous enough to run with it. It's a career where it's an occupational hazard to be buffeted by a lot of incoming. And I think I'm still dealing with some of the fallout from that, because the reality is, as many times as I repeat that it's not about me, you're exactly right. And it's something you should talk about with your students, for instance, that this line of work can take a toll. And, you know, I don't know if I will ever be totally better with respect to the impact of some of that. But, you know, it's also very fulfilling work, so it's worth it. I'm grateful for it.
Well, in terms of the fulfilling, I wonder, have you actually had enough time to kind of pause and process the impact of what you've done? I mean, obviously there's been moments where it's been very widely recognized, the Pulitzer and things like that, which are have got to be special. But I mean, have you considered the domino effect of, you know, you start, this is all in the last 5 years, basically, that so much has changed largely as a result of what you've done. And just, I guess I wonder, could you ever have imagined it being this far reaching?
Well, you know, it's lovely to hear that, and it's been very moving to have people, you know, come up to me and talk about the impact of various parts of my career and the work that I've done. And you know, that does help to know that what you're doing has given something of value to others, and I'm very cognizant of the fact that not everyone gets that. And certainly not everyone gets it to the extent that I've gotten it. You know, I've gotten plenty of validation, as you point out. So that is a lovely part of it. And, you know, I think it's important to not get distracted by that. And the nice thing about this line of work is it's humbling, ultimately. Like, ultimately, you've got to put your head down and just keep grinding it out. And it's hard work, and it is, as we've discussed at times, punishing. And, you know, that does keep it from being glamorous, despite those forms of validation, which I'm grateful for. And you know, you can see a lot of that push and pull, not to sound like a broken record, but in the series, I'm proud of the way they kind of interleaved all these complicated stories, including a bit of mine.
Well, just as a final question, I wonder if you can talk about, you know, we've seen your, you know, watching the series, we kind of see where it leaves us with you speaking with the PI who had been investigating you, and kind of how that chapter ended. But I guess I wonder, you always emphasize you're a journalist, not an activist, but you are always going to be associated with the Me Too movement. It's a big part of what you've helped to spark and support, you know, the thing that people are talking about now, looking forward, like, where is it now? Where is it headed? We're just coming off this Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial where, you know, the thing that was kind of said, a lot of people have sort of interpreted what happened there as maybe a backlash in a sense that to this idea that, you know, for some men, the idea of believe women was interpreted as, well, don't believe men. And therefore, there was a resentment about that. And I wonder if you feel that this is what was evident from that case. Is there a new chapter of the Me Too movement, or is that extrapolating too much from just one case, one situation?
Well, as you point out, my interaction with all of this is that of a kind of narrow fact finder. And there's an important cadre of people who work in activism, and that's a very different community of people with different goals. That's like Tarana Burke, who does all this wonderful community organizing. I will say I get asked all the time about whether, you know, there's some rollback of women's empowerment or the ability of survivors of sex crimes to speak or the ability of survivors of domestic violence, if we're using the current example. It's a question that I'm not the best person to answer because my role is, like, if there's terrible examples of certain forms of crime or corruption, like, then that's a big lead and I want to chase it. But I also am a little skeptical of that sort of pat analysis of, like, oh, there's, you know, there's this decision, there's this thing happening in the news cycle, and either, you know, wow, we're in such a better place, or boy, guess we're going back to the dark ages. I just don't think that's how it works, you know. I think, like, facts have been put into the world, the conversation changes over time. You know, where the kind of needle is culturally on some of the subtler ends of the conversation will change. But certainly the part of it that I have reported on, the part that you see in the show, just isn't that changeable. Like, you know, the crimes that we're talking about in those cases are crimes that would have been, you know, devastating and triggered legal repercussions 40 years ago or 20 years ago or in the present day. And, you know, the reporting was about the efforts to cover those sorts of things up. So I don't think that is part of the conversation that will change. I think there's the subtleties that are being explored where there's, like, sort of a cyclical conversation about it, and there's good and there's bad and there's progress and there's setbacks and so forth.
Well, it is called Catch and Kill, the podcast tapes. It's on HBO if people want to check it out. 6-part fascinating look at how you do what you do. And I really appreciate you coming on and talking about it. Thank you, Ron.
Thanks so much, Scott.
Thanks very much for tuning into Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.